Okay, we on? There we go. Sorry. Thank you. Sorry. So last night I did shave, and just accidents happen, you know. My wife hates it, so you can talk to her about that later. But new year, new beard, I guess. And we are diving right in. Here's what happens in January every year. We don't do, it's not necessarily like a vision series, but it is a introduction or a reintroduction to who we are as a church. We do it from a couple different angles, different years. We typically spend we spend all of our time for a couple of weeks in one passage, unpacking it, unpacking a theme, unpacking a pillar, unpacking a core part of who we are as a church. So you can get to know us or re-get to know us. It's also like aspirational, like we want to continue to become this kind of people in this city. And so for 3 weeks in January, for the next three Sundays, we're starting a three-week series called Mercy Made Visible. Do we have a slide for that? Is that up? Do we have that? Hunter doesn't have a slide, never mind. Anyway, it's a series that we're gonna be focusing on the idea, the reality of mercy, but I hope it's far more three-dimensional than just one-dimensional when you even hear that word. Because here's what you're gonna do. You're gonna hear stories of mercy, stories of justice, stories of kindness, stories of care over the next couple of weeks that really speak to the kind of place we wanna be and continue to be and become, that manifests mercy inside the walls of our church and outside the walls of our church. How are we caring for those amongst us? How are we caring for the forgotten in our city? How are we caring for the felt needs in our own body? How are we caring for the needs of the city? How are we doing all that? How are we walking beside hurting people? You're even gonna hear over the next couple of weeks something called the Mercy Team, which is launching. Training for that will start in February. Some of you are gonna be asked to go through that training. And it's got three kind of lanes that the Mercy Team is gonna help oversee: internal mercy, external mercy, and Napier. Napier is our sister congregation just south of downtown in the Napier Housing Projects. And so like, what does it look like to serve with them, to help all that they're facing in their neighborhood? And so our mercy team is a huge part of why we're doing this series on Mercy Made Visible, because we want to be a people of mercy, and not just in maybe a historic definition of that term, but what does it mean to be people of mercy and justice and care in the city? It's who we are, it's who we want to be, and continue to become. So 3 weeks we're spending in a little known book, but a very well-known passage of that book from the book of Micah in the Old Testament. Three verses from Micah, one of which is the only verse from Micah you've ever heard, Micah 6:8. But we're actually gonna read Micah 6:6-8 to give a little context, and then we'll dive in as we begin week one of Mercy Made Visible. So Micah in the Old Testament is between Jonah and Nahum, if you're looking for it. If not, it'll just be on the screen. You can trust me, this is what it says. Micah chapter 6, starting in verse 6, says this: "With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul?" And then here's verse 8, what most people have heard from Micah. "He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?" It's the word of the Lord. Amen. Okay, Micah, brief context, short little minor prophet. By the way, minor in the minor prophet, major prophet distinction in the Old Testament has nothing to do with importance, has only to do with length of the book, length of the writing. So it's minor by comparison to the major books of prophecy in the Old Testament, like Isaiah and Jeremiah, that are like 60 some odd chapters. Micah is a few chapters less than that, and so it is a minor prophet. The message is just as important though. And so in this minor prophet, here's what prophets always did. They came to God's people to speak on behalf of God to the people, oftentimes to call them to repentance over something. And Micah's main message, as he writes to the whole nation of Israel — it's actually two nations, it's Northern Kingdom and Southern Kingdom, but it's to all the people of God in the divided kingdom — here's what he says to them: judgment is coming for you. Judgment is coming, judgment is coming, judgment is coming. Because of all the injustice that you have committed, because of all the idolatry that you've committed, because of all the greed and the oppression of the poor, because of all the things that you have not done as God's people, and he's continually called you to be and do in the world, judgment is coming. Your enemy Babylon is going to come and take you up. And soon after Micah, they did. They took him into Babylonian captivity. Judgment is coming. And in response to the first five chapters of Micah, which is all judgment is coming, judgment is coming, judgment is coming, and here's why. In response to that, the people then in chapter 6, where we read, they have a response to go, oh, no. We don't want judgment. That sounds really hard. What do we have to pay to make this go away? Like, can't we just get 10,000 rivers of oil and thousands of rams and slaughtered calves? And can't we just bring a bunch of extra sacrifices to the temple to make all this judgment go away? Because here's how they were viewing the Lord, which was part of their problem, was this. Lord, you're just kind of this like transactional divine being that we have to satisfy. And so I know we've done wrong, but like, what do we got to do to make this go away? And what do we got to pay and what do we got to sacrifice? Because if you'll just take this money from us or take this sacrifice and offerings from us, then can your judgment just go away? We'll transact with you, God, and then we'll get back to what we were doing. Do you realize how not just offensive that is to a Lord who is saying, no, I actually want relationship with you, but also do you realize how small that makes the Lord's mission in the world and like his ideal for his people inhabiting the world? Like, he's not some tit for tat angry judge. It's like, well, you committed this many sins of unrighteousness, so now you got to sacrifice this many animals to make it right again. That's what they were viewing him as, though. What bloodshed do we have to do to make you be satisfied with us, and then we can get back to what we were doing? We don't really feel sorry for it. We don't really want to be in relationship with you or the world. We just kind of want to do our own thing and pay you with blood and money to go away. And so Micah shows up, calls the people out, and then speaks for them in verses 6 and 7, like, this is what you're saying in response to the Lord. And then verse 8 is the Lord's response to their, well, what do we got to empty out of our pockets to make your judgment go away? He said, no. It's not a transactional relationship I'm after. I'm after you. I'm after you and your role in the world. I'm after restoring this whole thing. And so Micah shows up with verse 8 and says, this is what returning to the Lord would look like. It's not a transaction. It's what a relationship with the Lord would make you into to be a people that do these things. This is what being restored to the Lord would look like. Verse 8. He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness or love mercy and to walk humbly with your God? He gives this threefold description: to do justice, to love mercy, love kindness, and to walk humbly with the Lord. And they are not meant to be separated out. Like, they exist in harmony together. They're meant to all three be done. And he's saying, this is what it would mean to return to the Lord and return to the heart of the Lord. You need them all together. And they sing together, they dance together. But over the next 3 weeks, we're gonna pull apart the three, not to isolate them, but to show you the beauty and the depth of each one as a call to what would it mean to be a people who did these three things in mercy made visible. So the first, start with this one, do justice. To do justice, perform acts of it, build systems of it, participate with justice. So what is justice, and why does the Lord start with this one, and why does he care about it so much, and how do we become a people who do justice? What is it? Why does he care about it and start with it, and how would we become it? So first, what is it? So justice really has one main word in the Old Testament, one main Hebrew word that gets translated into English, justice, for us. It's used hundreds of times in the Old Testament. It's almost annoying how like it shows up in basically every book of the Old Testament, this call for justice. And it's the Hebrew word mishpat. Mishpat is a word that's really simple to define. It's the call to do justice, and here's what it means. It means to treat people equitably. That's what it means. It literally means to give people what they deserve. Give people what they deserve, that's justice. That's fair, that's equitable. And you give people what they deserve in punishment, you give people what they deserve in protection, and you give people what they deserve in care. Every person should be treated fairly and equitably, regardless of race, regardless of social status, regardless of family systems, regardless of their history. Every person deserves justice. They should be treated equitably. They should get what they deserve. Now, we can hear that and go, oh, justice, that's for the court systems downtown. That's for the trials that have, you know, corrupt judges and corrupt lawyers, and we need justice in the court system. Yes. Justice Mishpat does affect how courts and trials should be run, and people deserve fair trials, and crimes deserve to be punished. That's justice. But Mishpat is not just speaking about like a fair criminal justice system. It certainly is speaking about that. It's just not only speaking about that. Mishpat is not just what punishment does someone deserve when they commit a crime, or what do they deserve to be defended if they're accused wrongly. Mishpat justice in the Old Testament also speaks about protection and care for a whole society of people. Like, what do people deserve? As like, what human rights made in the image of God, what value, what worth do they have, and what do they deserve? What would be justice for them existing in a city? So like, it's unjust, it's not fair, it's not equitable, it's not right for the city not to take care of its poor. That's unjust. That's not fair. Because you grew up in a different neighborhood or you grew up in a certain school system, you aren't given access to things that the rest of the city is. That's not equitable. That's not fair. That's not justice. It's unjust that some school systems are more resourced than other school systems. That's not fair. That's not justice. That's not right that people would not be given fair treatment, equal treatment based on their skin color or their gender or what neighborhood they grew up in or what their education or their social status is. That's not fair. It's unjust that people in the city would grow up in what's called a food desert. Napier is a food desert. They don't have easy access to healthy and sustainable fruit and vegetables and fresh food items. It's a food desert. That's unjust. That people in this city, because of where they were born into, live in an area of town that doesn't have access to clean and healthy food. It's unjust. It's not mishpat. It's not fair. It's not right. It's not equal treatment for all. Justice means giving people what they deserve. And as image bearers who are made in God's image, they deserve, every human being deserves dignity, respect, honor, care, protection. And here's the next layer down of that. Mishpat that is the ideal for a city where everybody's treated fairly and equitably. Mishpat would then say, justice would then say, if you're not getting justice, if you're not getting mishpat, then you are actually, the Bible would say in the Old Testament, you're being oppressed. It's actually the definition of oppression is people who are not treated with justice. If you're not getting just and fair treatment, then in the Lord's mind, you are suffering from oppression. And so the Lord calls his people to create systems and cultures and cities that are full of justice so that oppression might go away. We literally just sang it at Christmas, like during Advent. O Holy Night, in his name, all oppression shall cease. It was in our call to worship from Isaiah 61, like that he came to preach good news to the poor, to bind up the brokenhearted, to like set the captives free. He came to bring justice. That's all a justice chapter, Isaiah 61, on what the Messiah came to do. That all oppression would go away would mean that there are systems and cities full of justice. So it doesn't take a lot of imagination, but use it with me for a second to imagine who in the ancient world and who in the modern world would be a victim of oppression because they're not getting justice. Like, what people in a town are all, they're not starting on first base, they're not even starting in the dugout, they're not even in the stadium. That like, they don't experience justice, therefore they are oppressed. What people are more likely for that to be true of than other people? In the Old Testament, in an ancient, agrarian, patriarchal society, they're known as the quartet of the vulnerable. Four groups of people that the Lord, when he names one, he names them all. Because he's saying, these are the people who don't get justice. These are the people who don't get treated fairly. These are the people that have the deck stacked against them. These are the people who are suffering from injustice. And not just in the court system, but in the life system. The quartet of the vulnerable are the widows, the orphans, the immigrants, and the poor. You cannot read a Bible passage. It's so rare that you read one of the names of one of those people who's being mistreated in the Old Testament and they're not all four listed. Because in the Lord's mind, he's saying, these are the people who are already, like they're like born into, they experience from the start oppression and injustice. These are the people who are easily taken advantage of. They're crushed by the system. They never experience mishpat. They are not treated equally. They are not treated fairly. In Nashville, we would add to the quartet, have our own quartet. I would add a few more. I would say the immigrant, which is the refugee here, but the homeless, the single parent, which is the widow, but single dads too, the single parent, the uneducated. God, the uneducated are so forgotten in this city. Those with special needs, the elderly. It's like, fill in your own. Like, who are the people? That took me 30 seconds to think of those people. That, like, who are the people in this city that they don't get treated fairly? They get forgotten. They're pushed to the margins. Like, we don't want them to, like, have to, you know, suffer too much, but, like, we're not really concerned with them getting justice. We're not really concerned with them being taken care of and being fed and having clothes and being educated and being invited into thriving conversations. So the mishpat of a society, here's what gets kind of damning and kind of scary, is that the mishpat of a society, the justice of a society, the shining glory of if justice is happening in a city in the Old Testament, is always evaluated by the metric of how are you caring for the quartet of the vulnerable. Like every prophet, major and minor prophet in the Old Testament, when they show up as God's prosecuting attorney against the people of God to let them know the judgment that's coming to them, they always name those. They always say, yeah, you've worshiped idols and you've been greedy, but let me tell you how you've really offended the Lord. You have not cared for the vulnerable among you. It's always his metric. It's always his rubric. Like, how are you taking care of the people who are being oppressed among you? It's a violation of justice. To say justice for some but not for all is by definition unjust. Like justice does not exist if it's not justice for all. And so then another word that gets used when talking about justice in the Old Testament is the Hebrew word tzadika, which is a word that literally means righteous or like righteous living. The righteous, those who are just justice lovers, they're righteous, and righteousness leads to justice. The more a city has righteous people, the more justice is happening. And here's what it is to describe a righteous person. It's not talking about like the city officials that we need that are righteous. We need those. It's not talking about like the rule makers and the lawmakers and the elite and the wealthy. We need all those people to be righteous. Righteousness applies to everybody. It's not just like if you have power to create social change, you can be righteous. Righteousness in the Old Testament, righteous day-to-day living is for everybody. And the more that there is righteous living by everybody, the more there will be justice for everybody. Righteousness leads to justice. It's the day-to-day integrity, day-to-day generosity, day-to-day fairness and equity that people live with that creates justice in the world. Here's what the Old Testament would paint. Righteous living, righteousness from people leads to a society of mishpat, of justice. Because everyone is in right relationship. Everyone's treating each other fairly. The poor aren't forgotten. The widow is taken care of. The immigrant isn't poorly mistreated. Bruce Waltke is an Old Testament scholar. I took a few classes with him in seminary. He is smarter than everyone in the room. And he has spent his life studying semantic languages, Hebrew in particular, but he studied a whole bunch of ancient languages. And one of his gifts to the church is there's only about 10,000 words in ancient Hebrew, and he has basically looked at every word in the ancient semantic region and helped define them by like all of their usages in all of the like ancient Near East languages. And so he's got really helpful, like nuanced definitions of Hebrew words because he's given his whole life to define them. And this is how he defines righteousness. This is how he defines, what does it mean to be a righteous person in the ancient world and in ancient Israel in the Old Testament? What did the authors mean when they said righteousness? The righteous person, Bruce would say, is a person who disadvantages themselves for the sake of the community. Righteous person is a person who disadvantages themselves for the community. And the wicked person, the unrighteous person, is a person who sees their resources as just belonging to them and them only. So righteousness, through all of its usages in the whole Old Testament and the whole ancient world, is someone who sees themselves as what I have does not just belong to me. It's for the sake of the city. It's for the sake of my neighbor. It's for the sake of my family. And the wicked person, the unrighteous person, is the person who sees their position and their money and their resources and what they've been given as, this is just for me to use for me. The righteous person says, what I have belongs to the other. And the wicked person, the unrighteous person, is who says, no, no, what I have is mine. I earned it. That's mine. I worked for this status. I worked for this money. I get to choose how I use these things. Now, don't kill the messenger, okay? I'm just, don't, me or Bruce, okay? Don't kill, like, he's just saying, this is the biblical definition. You have to deal with this. Righteousness is seeing yourself as being willing to be disadvantaged for the sake of other people. And unrighteousness is the opposite of that. And there is this reality of how righteous living leads to justice for all in a city by what we would maybe say is called like trickle-down justice. Like the more righteous acts that there are in a city, the more people are treated fairly and systems of oppression and injustice get eradicated. Trickle-down justice that connects everyday lives with everyday choices and everyday decisions with justice in the city. It's this way of thinking. Here's a couple examples. And it sounds like, oh, isn't that a stretch? But no, it's really not. This is the way of thinking, like righteous living that leads to justice for all would connect these two things, like porn usage with prostitution and human trafficking. Because you realize that like prostitution and human trafficking, which you're gonna hear about a ministry next week that we support that is doing beautiful work in that space, but you realize that's a supply and demand industry. Like it doesn't exist if people don't want it. And so this mindset of like, well, but I can just kind of do what I want with my computer and it's not really hurting anybody. But do you realize what appetite that's satiating? Do you realize what appetite that's feeding? It creates the demand for sex with who I want when I want it. So what would, did you see the trickle down? Like, do you see how like porn usage, I'm not blaming you if that's you. I'm saying, do you see the connection? Like it creates a demand for something. Or how about this? A little bit less grotesque. You're welcome. Happy New Year. How about this? How about like, hey, you being greedy at work? Like if you're a boss or a manager and you thinking like, well, I deserve a bonus and I need to maybe like get rid of some people so that I get some more money. Or our bottom line is all that really matters. Like, do you realize how like greed and your own gain and your own advancing, like I'll step on these people to get my brand and my image and my network. I'll grow my own self. Do you realize how greed doesn't actually produce people being like treated well, paid fairly, fair wages in a city, people getting what they deserve when they like when it comes to paycheck time, splitting profits? Do you realize how like your greed actually influences poverty in the city? Like, and I'm not trying to overreach. I'm saying that's how the Bible paints the picture, is like what you do in your day-to-day actually does affect the justice for the city. That's the vision. It's not, oh, well, like, let's let all the lawmakers create justice for all. It's like, no, how are you living with your spouse and with your employees and with your coworkers and with your roommates? Two-term definition of justice. Righteous living leads to justice for all, would create a people who think differently about themselves in the world. And how can I use my vocation? How can I use the call of God on my life to actually be someone who does justice? Read an example this week, a great one. It's from one of my favorite preachers, maybe my favorite preacher. She's a woman named Fleming Rutledge. She's about 90, Episcopalian priest up in New York. She's amazing. You should read everything she's ever written and listen to anything you can by her. I've got a huge crush on her. My wife's cool with it. But like she's incredible. And she's got books of sermons. You can go plow through. She talks about this, this connection between like seeing yourself differently and living righteously and its effect on justice in the city and in the world. She tells an example from the journalism industry. It's been said before, she says, that in the journalism industry, the best columnists, the best newspapers, the best journalists, they are God's mouthpiece to the world, giving a voice to those who don't have a voice, like telling stories to the world that otherwise would never be told, that the world needs to hear. They see people no one else sees. They uncover things. They discover things that the world needs to know about and speak for the Lord. So this famous journalist named Mary McGrory, never met her. She's passed, I believe, was a writer for the Washington Post in the 80s and 90s and won all these awards. And during one of her awards reception speeches from the National Press or something, a big prestigious award she was getting, Columnist of the Year or something like that, this is what she said in her reception speech to the award she was getting. I love this. We would have been friends. She said, "No great men call me. Do you know who calls me? Losers. If you want to abolish landmines, if you want to reform campaign spending, if you want to save children from abuse or stupid laws or thick-headed judges, you have my phone number. Call me. Like, to say that to a room full of people, like, none of y'all call me because I'm not telling your stories. I'm telling the stories of the people where injustice is happening. And those stories need to be told. She didn't have to, like, stop her vocation to go, like, only work at the homeless shelter. That's great if that's what the Lord's calling you to do, but that's not the only place justice lives. It actually is like, no. How do a whole group of people, a whole community of people in hospitals and in classrooms and in family rooms and in coffee shops and in justice systems and in legal systems, all of it, how do they do justice? They live righteously. They think about other people. They don't see their stuff and their place and their achievements and their network as just to be used for them. They use it on other people. That's righteousness. And righteousness leads to justice because God's people, according to Micah 6:8 and a bunch of other places, are to be a force of justice in the world. God's people are to be getting busy about creating a whole society where all oppression ceases. And people aren't thrown in jail unjustly, and people don't go hungry at night, and people have clothes, and education is fair for all, and there is a shining light of no oppression in the city of Nashville. That's what it means to do justice. A city where mishpat reigns. That's what it is. Okay. Why does God care about this so much? Like, why is it his first one in the triplet of things that we're going to look at? Why is doing justice all over the Old Testament, and why does Micah call the people to it as the first thing when he's trying to get them to return to him? Well, if you want to get into the heart of God, there's actually a little clue in the passage that I've overlooked for years, never preached through Micah, but there's a little clue in the wording that actually helps us understand why God cares about this so much. Look with me again at verse 8. He says, he has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. He has told you, O man, what is good. So I was reading about that. I read that line again this week, and I was prepping. I was like, oh, he has told you, implying we've been over this. He's told you. He's already told you. So I started thinking like, oh, well, I wonder how many times in Micah 1 through 5, the Lord mentions doing justice and loving mercy and walking humbly, and I wonder how many times he's like beat this into their head so that by chapter 6, it's like, he's told you, do justice. So I went back and looked. Guess how many times doing justice is mentioned in verses in chapters 1 through 5? Zero. So I was like, well, hold on. He's told you. No, he hasn't. Unless it's saying something far more grand than just, I told you in the last couple chapters. He has told you, O man, what is good. Where has he told them? He's been telling them since the Garden of Eden. He's been telling them since the beginning of time. He's been telling them since Adam and Eve, this is what's good. This is what I hope for the world. How do we know that he's been telling the story of justice, doing justice for the world? How do we know he's been telling that story since the beginning? Well, ask any Hebrew or Orthodox Jew, ask anybody, what made the Garden of Eden so Eden-like? Which Eden is a word that just means delight. So what made the garden so delightful? And they will tell you that before sin, before the fall, here's what the garden was. The garden was the cathedral of shalom. Shalom is an interesting Hebrew word. We translate it peace in English, but it means a lot more than that. It's been defined a bunch of different ways. It's really hard to distill down into one definition. But here's what one theologian said. He said, shalom is the webbing together, even that imagery, like the webbing together, like it's all interconnected, the webbing together of God, humans, and all creation in equity, fulfillment, and delight. It's the webbing together of God, humans, and all creation in equity, fulfillment, and delight. Shalom means universal flourishing, universal wholeness. No needs in a city are unmet. All gifts that God has given are being used for the enjoyment of everyone else. And it's all happening under the banner of God's delight and God's love of his world. And so when you, shalom is this like atom bomb word that is meant to like explode your imagination, as when you see shalom, when you hear shalom, you think, oh, shalom is the way that the world was meant to be. Shalom is the way that the world was intended to be. And so Adam and Eve in the garden, they're living in the cathedral of shalom, where all is right. There is perfect harmony between Adam and Eve and the Lord, between Adam and Eve and each other, between Adam and Eve and creation. There was no thorns or thistles. There was no death or decay. Everything was thriving. Everything was flourishing. And they're commanded in Genesis 1 to take that shalom to the ends of the earth, to be fruitful and multiply out this beauty of God's delight everywhere, where everything is as it should be. God's webbing together in equity, fulfillment, and delight of all creation. Shalom is the way things should be. And then you flip the page from Genesis 2, and Adam and Eve shatter the shalom that we were made for. They rebel against the Lord, and literally in the same distinction that Bruce Waltke would make between righteousness and unrighteousness and wickedness and righteousness, is they decided in wickedness to live only for themselves. We would rather do things our way. We would rather do what we want to do and not what you would have us do. They turn in on themselves and live narcissistically and selfishly and navel gaze and only think about what they want. And in shalom being shattered, literally, if you can think about shalom like this big tapestry, sin comes in and like pulls the threads apart and frays all the edges, and it literally disintegrates the shalom that the world was made for. That's what sin did. It shattered and defecated and vandalized the shalom that the world was made for. And so, right after the fall, God, in his kindness, says, I actually want to restore the shalom that I intended for the world. I'm going to do it through my people. Genesis chapter 12, Abraham, you're going to be a bless. I'm going to bless you so that you can be a blessing to the whole world. We're going to like redeem this. We're going to restore this. Restore the shalom that we originally intended for the world. So if shalom is the goal, shalom is the ideal, capital I, Plato and Aristotle, like it is the ideal behind everything. If shalom is the goal, connect this back to Micah 6 and the whole Old Testament and its picture of justice and righteousness. Do you know what that two-word definition of righteousness that leads to justice, do you know the end product of that in a city? To bring equity and justice to all? Do you know the way that trickle-down righteousness and justice in a family and in a city and in a world? Do you know what gets created when there are righteous people living righteously, creating systems and cultures and cities of justice for all? Do you know what happens? Shalom. A city that's full of peace, a city that's full of human flourishing and beauty and art and good food, and no one's forgotten. Relationships are restored. There's no bickering or divorce. Cultures are thriving. Everybody has equity. Everybody is treated fairly and with honor and dignity. That's shalom. Righteous living that leads to justice for all creates shalom. See, it has to be understood, again, that God's call for justice is not, one, only for the court system, although it certainly is for the court system and the legal system. But it's not like, oh, just the elected officials, just the elites, just those with money and power and influence, that's who goes and creates justice. The Bible's view of justice is that there are righteous people doing righteous things, caring about justice and caring about their neighbor, and not only living for themselves and living for others and creating justice. And when justice reigns, shalom is restored. That's the mission of God in the world. That's how he can say in Micah 6:8, he has told you, oh man, what is good. He's been telling you since the beginning, this is what this was all made for. He's been telling you since the garden, this is what the people of God have always been called to and what they are to always be about. Do justice and restore shalom. All right, so quick question. Just a show of hands. How many of y'all on your New Year's resolutions this year put down, I want to do more justice and restore more shalom? Yeah, me either. Here's what I would say is, because like even just in something as simple and as like trivial as New Year's resolutions, do you see like how wickedly we live? Like we don't want shalom. Now the redeemed part of you does if you belong to Jesus, but the flesh in you is still doing this to you, still only thinking about you. Like everyone's New Year's resolutions is just how can you be a better you? See? How can you do more for you? How can you make more money? How can you work out more? How can you do like dry January, which sounds dumb. Like how can you, some of you should, but like how can you, like all the resolutions is only thinking about self. Because left to ourself, we don't think about other people. We think wickedly. We don't think righteously. And do you know, like, if it was just this simple of like, just tell you what justice is and you'd go do it. Do you know that there's more books after Micah? Which means this, after Micah does this call to go do justice, they don't do it. It's not like, oh, well, now that you said it that way, Micah, in that cute little triplet, you know, do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly, we got it now, we'll do it now. But it doesn't happen. It doesn't make them people that go do justice. So here's the ultimate question. Not just what is justice, not just why does God care about it, but what will make us people that do it? What will transform us into people who do justice? Well, if you remember the way that things were supposed to be in the garden, the state of shalom, the cathedral of shalom, everything was right between God and man, and man and man, and man and woman, and man and woman in creation. All was right in the tapestry. And then the very people, the image bearers that God had commissioned and created to go spread the shalom and the beauty and the Eden and the delight to the ends of the world, like be fruitful and multiply and take this everywhere. The very people who he had commissioned were the very ones that rebelled against him. And so maybe a bigger question as we start this journey of our own transformation would be to ask this, because you need to get to know the Lord on this. Why in the world did the Lord not just start over? Like, why didn't he just eradicate the good world he had made? Hey, Adam and Eve, you had a good shot. You failed. So we're just going to start over with people who won't do that to me. Why didn't he do that? Well, if he's the kind of God who is shalom, he created shalom, do you realize that also makes him the God who doesn't just want to start over with something? He wants to redeem something. He actually cares more about restoring something than he does starting over with something. He's like a remaking God. He's a creating and a recreating God. And so if shalom is the webbing together of the Lord with all creation in equity, fulfillment, and delight, do you realize when a part, like it's a love-driven mission, like he wants to delight in what he has made. And so if part of that creation rebels against him, it's not in his nature just to give up on them. It's in his nature to go and restore the very people who have shattered his plan. Do you know the thing that the Lord, do you know the entity in creation that the Lord longed for shalom with more than anything else? You. His people, his image bearers. So if he wants to restore shalom, and restore has to do with righteousness and justice for all, if he wants to restore delight, how is he going to restore delight? How is he going to restore shalom with people who despised him? How could he bring shalom to such unjust people? How could he bring shalom to wicked, unrighteous people? And I know in the West, when I say those terms, unjust, unrighteous, wicked, a couple things happen. We either like dismiss them, or we fill our imagination with faces of people, other people who we think are like righteous and wicked, unrighteous and wicked, and people that we hate. Those are the people. In the West, we don't like admitting. We all admit like, well, I'm imperfect. I have flaws. But we love to like dance and like justify those things. Like when we treat someone terribly in our home or in our family, it's like, well, but if you knew what kind of day I had had, like I'm not perfect, but I just kind of had an outburst. That wasn't really me. We're like master manipulators. We're master self-justifiers. We're master defenders. Like how many of you have defended a wrong that someone has brought to you with, yeah, but if you knew my heart, if you knew what I was trying to do. I was like, yeah, that's true like 4% of the time. Do you know how often we do things wickedly and unrighteously and we mean to? Like, we all have elements of our lives that are completely indefensible and not justifiable. We have a really hard time in the West. Thank you, Enlightenment. We have a really hard time in the West admitting, confessing the like razor thin line between who you are and being like a Nazi. And that maybe the only difference between you and a Nazi is that you were born where you were born and not in Germany in the 30s. That maybe the only difference between like the rage and the pride and the bigotry and the hatred that lives in you is just that that seed in you hasn't been watered as much. And the Lord in his common grace has allowed for you to not have that evil fester more. But if you will admit it, that like the heinousness that goes way down, the thoughts, the actions, the words, the fantasies, the things that you think about that you could tell no one that you've ever thought about, if you'll have the courage to admit that that lives in you, which is really hard for Western people, here's the next scary thing you're gonna have to deal with, which is good that you deal with reality, but it's scary, is this. We have to deal with the fact that we know what justice demands of us. We now have to deal with the fact, what does the judge of all the earth, God, in his perfect righteousness and perfect justice and perfect judgment, what do we deserve from him if evil lives in us? Well, justice from the Lord would say that you and I ought to be outcast forever. Justice from the Lord would say we have to be banned from the garden and left outside the gate. Justice from the Lord would say you and I don't deserve shalom. Like, we haven't earned it. And justice is getting what you deserve. It's just for the Lord to say, this is the judgment that you've deserved from me because you have vandalized the shalom that I intended for the world. This is now what justice is for you. Justice is his judgment. That's what the whole book of Micah is all about. This is your judgment, and here's why you deserve it. But for God to then be a God who cares about restoring shalom and restoring justice, here's what God can't do. He can't just come and say like, well, I guess I'll just like muster up some niceness and we'll just kind of wipe your slate clean and we'll forgive you again for this thing that you've done or keep doing. And we'll just like, we'll kind of count the tallies of how many times I've had to forgive you, but we won't really bring judgment and justice to your evil. Do you realize that like a God who is just kind enough to wipe the slate clean, but not a God who is full of justice and judgment, he's not God then. He's certainly not a God that can restore shalom, because shalom requires justice and judgment, fair and equitable treatment for all. So for God to just say, well, this is true in the West of us too, especially in like pop Christianity. We love to talk about the love of God, and we should, because the whole Bible's about it, but we make it shallow and hollow. Like we minimize it when we talk about the love of God as just like, well, God just, he's like the forgiving, nice kind of God. He's not a judging God. He's a loving God who just forgives, which is true. But what we mean by that is we strip away all the cost of it. Like, do you know that the fabric of the world was torn by our hands? And a nice and shallow, kind, forgiving, loving God who just does that stuff and just like, he's not here to judge, he's just here to forgive. A God that does that can never restore shalom. Shalom demands justice. Shalom demands judgment. It was said this week, I read again by Fleming Rutledge, she was quoting someone else, but she said, to speak of God's love only in terms of forgiveness is far too weak a word for what God actually does. Like, do you know that Jesus didn't come and just wipe your sins under the rug? He came to actually bear your sin, to become your sin, so that he might atone for them. That's so much different than just him forgiving you one more time. Because in Jesus atoning for your sin, bearing up under the weight of your sin on the cross and bearing it, here's what he did. He satisfied justice. He achieved justice by plunging himself beneath the flood of the judgment that you and I deserved. Because justice is getting what you deserve. That's what we deserved. But God doesn't merely just come and forgive you and say, we'll try again next time. We'll wipe your slate clean one more time. He actually took, in the person of Jesus, through his blood, he took the blow of justice from you and for you. So now, and I know this is like paradigm shifting. This is hard to comprehend this shift. But do you know now that the living, resurrected Jesus, nail-pierced hand Jesus, who's in the heavenly throne room, he does not stand before God and plead mercy for you? I know that sounds weird to say. It's like, no, we get mercy from God. Yes, but here's what we think that looks like. Jesus standing before the throne and saying, God, Elliot did it again. Can you find it in your heart? Just be merciful to him. Don't be mad at him. Can he have another chance? Will you be kind and not punish him? Be merciful to him. Jesus doesn't stand and plead mercy for you now. Do you know what he does in the throne room? Jesus stands and pleads justice for you. That's insane unless what you deserve has been flipped. God, give my people justice. And give them justice based on the merits of what I have done for them. Because of what I've done for them, God, it is now just for you. It is fair and equitable and righteous and just for you, God, to welcome my brothers and sisters to the table. It's just for you. It's fair for you. It's right for you. They deserve this now. It's just for you to call them into the family and bind them to yourself forever and adopt them into your home and to never abandon them. They deserve that now because of what I've done for them and what I've taken from them. Dote on them, God, and delight in them. They deserve it now. It's just for you to do so. Give them justice. Give them every drop of justice based on what I have accomplished for them. Do you realize Jesus achieving justice for you and not just merely forgiving you is far more costly and far more precious? We get a little glimpse of this cost and preciousness in this one verse in Micah 6. Look with me again just for 1 minute, 2 minutes at verse 7. He says, this is the people saying, what do we got to pay to make this judgment go away? They say in verse 7, will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? That's the people's ask through Micah. Is this what we need for shalom with the Lord again? Is this what we need to pay a price? But please know the hint, the whisper, please know the foreshadowing that's happening in verse 7. What this passage is saying is actually a foreshadow of what the Lord would do himself. The Lord didn't require the firstborn of his people. He gave up his own. The Lord gave the fruit of his own body for the sin of our soul. And so here's the picture, like start to finish, when you understand like what it is, what justice is, why he cares about it, and how we become it. Here's what happens to us. Do you realize that Jesus wanted shalom with you and shalom restored with you so desperately, he brought it to you and paid for it? Before he made you earn it or before he made you pay him, he restored you with justice and shalom. Like we were the poor and the powerless. We were the ones who were suffocating under the weight of justice and judgment against us. And instead of leaving us there outside the city gates in total abandonment, Jesus went there for us. He took the weight of justice and judgment on himself. And so now here's how that changes us. Because we see that like justice brings shalom, and shalom is what we've always been called to and called to restore. Here's what happens. We bring justice and shalom to the world because it was brought to us. And we don't make people earn it. We don't make people say like, well, we don't say to people like, well, when you show me that you're serious about this and you finally want to pull up your own bootstraps, then maybe we'll talk about equity and honor and dignity for you. That wasn't done for us. That's not how God brought shalom to us. That's not how God satisfied justice for us. We have a God who loves justice and he loves shalom and he came and did it for us. And so now we go and do the same. So let's pray and then we'll come and feast and commune on Jesus together. Jesus, you brought shalom and you satisfied justice. And so now when you plead for us, it's really hard for us to wrap our mind around this, but because of your blood, Jesus, we now deserve to be treated like a son and a daughter. You've restored what the locust has eaten. You've restored what sin and shame would stain us with. You've brought us back home. And so Jesus, as people who have had shalom brought to them, had justice satisfied for them, would you make us righteous? Make us a people who live righteously, to use our place, our space, our spirit, our words, our network, our money, our time, to bring justice to the city. Help us to get a vision of shalom and seeing its beauty, and help us to bring that beauty to the world around us. We pray in your name. Amen.